Hey you, and welcome to Deconstructor of Fun podcast. This is your host, Mishka Katkov, and this is a new segment on our podcast. I'm recording this segment with my friend, Eric Sufert, who's the founder of Mobile Dev Memo, QuantMar, has worked in multiple different growth positions across some of the top companies, and is just the most knowledgeable person about growth that I know. We're going to dive into all topics regarding growth. We're going to call it how we see it. This podcast is going to be hopefully insightful, definitely opinionated, and most likely entertaining. So please review it, please like it, please share it, and please do DM us and let us know how you liked the episode and what do you want to hear about in the future. So without further ado, big kudos to our sponsors.
We pretty much use just about every single product that IronSource offers. We're completely integrated with the platform. Of course, the mediation products, all ad products, and the company that can assist us in doing UA and monetization and all the additional products that come along with it. It takes a lot of headache away from us. It takes a lot of the hard, busy work off of our hands, having a kind of an all-in-one platform.
You just heard Andrew Stone. He's the CEO at Random Logic Games, who use IronSource's platform to grow their games in the smartest way possible. If you want to grow like Random Logic, you can get the SDK on IronSource's website. That's ironsrc.com.
We all know it. Mobile marketing is going through a paradigm shift. With the industry moving towards a more aggregate way of measuring marketing efforts, marketers' ability to measure and understand the impact of their marketing investments is further curtailed. AppsFlyer, though, is not sitting on the sidelines. The company has set a goal to help their customers and the entire mobile ecosystem to successfully navigate the new era of mobile marketing. And that's where AppsFlyer's latest product, the Incrementality Solution, comes to play. It's a product that truly empowers marketers to gain a better understanding of the real value that their marketing efforts hold. AppsFlyer's incrementality solution is built around remarketing. It simplifies the process of designing, executing, and analyzing incremental lift tests at scale, which previously was something that only the biggest players on the market were able to do. With incrementality, marketers can focus on the end goal of their test without actually having to worry about the heavy lifting that comes with it. To learn more about incrementality and to read the success stories from publishers like Kabam, I suggest that you head out to appsflyers.com. So I wanted to just do a hot start because we always talk a bunch of bullshit and people are just like, get to the topic. So we're going to get right to the topic of various growth stuff. So you've been covering platform wars, and I looked at the previous post in Mobile Dev Memo, and they go back to like 2017 and almost 2015. So you've seen this IDFA thing happen. You've seen what's going on with Apple and Facebook, and there's a lot of things that has happened throughout the years, like the App Store bans the App Stores, App Store within the App Stores. There's the rewarded video ads that was blocked and then backtracked in 2014. There's the broken app discovery issue that was kind of fixed with the subscriptions and the search ads. Then Facebook started doing various moves from mobile app install products to ads on Instagram to audience network advertising platform to WhatsApp, where they got all the phone numbers, to the news feeds and the video ads, to Messenger ads, to Instant Games. Like, there's a bunch of stuff. And then when finally this IDFA deprecation happened, people were like, where is this coming from? And it's been going on for such a long time because these are giant companies. So can you walk me through of this platform war? Like are we in the mobile missile? Like, are we in the DEFCON 10 or whatever you call it? Or is this a Cuban missile crisis? Or is this a hot war, cold war? What's going on?
I think it's a hot war. I mean, it's funny because, the IDFA stuff took a lot of people by surprise. But, I mean, I've been writing about this stuff since 2017, just hypothesizing about what might happen. And I think, you could always kind of see that hostility between Apple and Facebook, right? I mean, it's funny because I wrote this piece in 2017 called The Coming War Between Apple and Facebook. And I kind of laid all this out, how I thought it was going to play out. And I ran it by some people. And one of them was a former Facebook employee, good friend of mine, whom, I highly respect, very, very intelligent guy. And he said, look, this is great, but you know, they both have a common enemy, right? They both have a common enemy. That's Google. And so I couldn't see them actually going to war with each other, because that would leave them both kind of vulnerable to Google, right? If they're sort of occupied with, you know, with this kind of open hostility, you know, with each other, then Google could come in and sort of exploit that. But I think what that missed. So what happened? And I think he was right at the time, and that's why this stuff kind of didn't develop and didn't get hot and didn't spill over until now. Was that Facebook just had nowhere to go, right? If you thought of them as like a pot and the water was boiling, and you know that lid's gonna blow off soon. Like that's, I think Facebook or Apple got to the point where they're like, look, this lid's about to go. Facebook's ambition has always extended beyond just being a mobile, like a mobile based platform or like a mobile app on your phone, right? And they experimented with the Facebook phone. You know, I don't know if you read that leaked email from Zuckerberg about potentially acquiring Unity, about why they would need to do that, because they have to own the hardware, they have to own the form factor. So I think like this setup has existed at least since 2017, but I think it got hot because basically Facebook owned App Store distribution, right? Facebook and to some extent Google, but it was more obvious with Facebook, and Google owns more of the pipe so they can kind of get away with it more. But Facebook was just this layer on top of the App Store that basically ran a cash register, right? Like developers just pouring money into Facebook ads. Apple is not getting a cut, and it was impacting the sort of look and feel and the tone of the App Store, right? I mean, this is why you know, Apple has no control over the editorial anymore. Like the popularity of apps, which apps, Apple's not a kingmaker. Like which apps are popular, which apps hit the top of the charts. And I think that was part of the reason why they diversified the editorial a couple years ago, right? And they created the different, you know, the sort of the top apps page and the apps we like page, and they made it less of just a list of top apps, right? They actually added some commentary. Just so they could take back control. But really, that's not where users discover apps. The App Store is not a discovery mechanism. It's Facebook. And I think that was actually, you know, one of the motivations behind, I don't know if you saw yesterday, they just hired Josh Ellman. Yeah. And he's going to be a PM for app discovery, right? They've created a whole role for that. They've created a whole division within the App Store. So he'll report up to the App Store lead, and he's just going to, all he's going to be doing is running a PM function for app discovery. They have to take that control back. I think that's the kind of genesis of the war.
So they have to take back the control. Does that mean that, because there's like two things there, they have to take back the control for the usability factor, or is this driven by revenues? Like which one is more important?
I think it's both. I think it's not very Apple-y to have these hyper casual games be top downloaded for those to be like the most popular apps that people are playing, right? That's just not an Apple. That doesn't fit within the Apple paradigm. Apple's very design centric.
They for sure don't use Metal.
Yeah.
For the latest in 3D touch.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. No Apple Maps integration into that. I was working on a you'll know what game I'm talking about. I was working on a game that was a real world map game, like a location based game. And we went to Apple and we were showing them.
Did it have
them.
Tanks?
Yeah, it had tanks. and our App Store rep was like, you know, this would be a lot better if you used Apple Maps. And we were like, what? Like that would you talk about like starting from zero? You'd have to rebuild this game from scratch. But Apple, it doesn't make any sense. Anyway. it's that. So it's just the look and feel. It's sort of like runs counter to the way the App Store that Apple likes to run to sort of manage their products. But also it's just not good for Apple. Apple is interested in the App Store supporting. Well, the App Store is a revenue driver, right? The App Store drives services revenue, right? And it's a big component of that. And that's become much, much more important for Apple in the past X years. And so Apple wants to wrap its arms around all of that, right? So it's not just about, you know, the control, I mean, which it is, but it wants to use that as a means of driving like revenues that it feels like are sustainable and that it actually gets a cut of. It doesn't get a cut of any hyper casual games revenue. It doesn't get any cut of any ad revenue, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it wants to promote the apps that actually sort of like lead to like revenue growth for it, which a lot of these apps don't, like hyper casual, any sort of advertising driven app doesn't. But then also like the look and feel aspect of it, That's a real differentiator, right? I mean, that's a real platform differentiator. If it can make that like the premier destination, which is more in line with like the kind of the iPhone's appeal, then potentially that helps to drive hardware revenues. Potentially that helps drive stickiness, right, with the platform. So I think there's a revenue component to that. I don't know if the revenue piece is as direct as people think. I mean, I think a lot of people think, no, this was just a play to sideline Facebook so that Apple could kind of promote its own advertising network. I think that's part of it. And if you look at some of the details around Apple's ad targeting settings in iOS 14 and how they're kind of privileged in that respect, they have like a basically in a parallel ad targeting set of ad targeting parameters that are not affected by opt-in. They're not affected by any of the ATT stuff. That's suspect, right? And so there's part of that I think is at play here, and part of that growth in that in ASA as a sort of revenue stream for the services division. But I don't think that was the sole reason. I actually wrote an article about it. I think there's like four motivations, and they're all kind of like you know, there's like sort of equal enthusiasm for all of them. It's called Why is Apple Reshaping the App Economy? But I think revenue is part of it, and ad revenue is part of it. But I think it was a combination of a bunch of these things. It also just wanted to hurt Facebook.
Yeah. So when they threw the grenade, the IDFA grenade, and kind of blew up the, you know, the high level, not high level, the sophisticated performance marketing, it doesn't really hurt Apple because they are essentially pushing back the control to the storefront, and they have their own SK ad network with Apple search ads that are actually benefiting from that type of stuff. So for them, blowing up the sophisticated route is not a problem. And also it kind of helps them because it hurts the companies that are most optimized in their performance marketing. Am I correct? And it kind of helps the medium and the low level to rise up. And those are the perfect clients for Apple because they listen to anything Apple says, because for them, yeah, the featuring is so important.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So this helps King. This helps Rovio. This helps these like these companies that make broadly appealing apps that, you know, don't rely on whale driven monetization, because it's really, I mean, I think people call this the apocalypse. And in some ways it's apocalyptic just in the fact that it requires a ton of work. I mean, even if you are a King or Rovio, I mean, you're still running UA and you still have to reconstruct your entire UA infrastructure. And this is a pain. It's painful, right? It's not an easy process. Everything had been built around the IDFA, but there's life after ATT. For some companies, there's not, right? But it's not that many companies, and it's not that big of a segment of the market. I think the problem is just the work involved in rebuilding the infrastructure. But once you do that, I mean, some companies are going to benefit from this. Some companies will be better off for this, mm-hmm, right? I mean, this isn't like, it's not universally painful, and it's not evenly painful.
Yeah. That's why I kind of, I mean, that's the way I was seeing. And also, what do you think is going to happen to IPs? I mean, so you had this GDC talk about IPs before, and you kind of, you know, dropped the mic on IPs. So going back now, if you could do a GDC talk, I mean, you could do a GDC talk about IPs next year. Are they going to be more valuable for mobile games now that the IDFA deprecated? So you get basically that broad appeal.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I think so. I mean, the same problems will still apply, which is like there are crappy IPs and there are IP owners that are not willing to, you know, make reasonable sort of, you know, negotiations in these kind of licensing deals. But yeah, I think for sure IP is going to, we're going to go back to the 2015 era. Mm. I mean, you remember when Glue just started off that IP frenzy? We're going to go back to that time where everybody's going to be fighting over these IPs. Just because
it's going to be good. Scopely is going to be well positioned.
Yeah, but a lot of their games are these 4X games that are dependent on the whale monetization, right?
Kinda. But do you remember the Game of Thrones game from Warner Brothers? That did extremely well. And word on the street was that their CPIs were ridiculously low. Like for a strategy game, they couldn't buy enough.
Huh. Well, I don't know about that. But you know, I mean, I guess yeah, Scopely's got Yahtzee.
Yeah,
they got the Looney Tunes, but the WWE Avatar, game is
they got the Marvel.
Yeah.
Again, no. What's that called? The zombie game.
Walking Dead.
Walking Dead. Yeah.
Yeah.
WWE. They got a bunch of stuff. I feel like almost everything that they have is very much IP driven. But yeah, that's just one example. And you mentioned King because they have such a big network already. and everybody knows Candy Crush, and they're now doing Crash Bandicoot and all these kind of like casual Activision IPs. And of course, Rovio with Angry Birds, they're probably gonna benefit from this. So I wanted to ask one more question. You said Google is the enemy of both Facebook and Apple. How come?
Well, because they own the OS and the ad network, right? I mean, they're the hardware and the distribution mechanic, which has always been their stick. Their stick, going back to Google as a desktop ad network, has always been they were the exchange and they were the DSP. Like, they owned the pipes and they owned the kind of business logic on top. And that's the same as it, you know, apply that to mobile. They own Android and they own the ad network on top of Android. And so that's just, and which is just kind of, that's why, I mean, like, Apple owns iOS and Facebook owned the ad network, but neither of them had both. Well, Google has both, right? And it's, that's a very sort of intimidating opponent.
Yeah. That makes sense. So do you think Google is going to follow this IDFA deprecation? Like, does it help? I mean, they don't use IDFA. They had the different ID measurement, but does it help them or hurt them if they kind of follow the suit, or when they follow the suit?
They can't follow in exactly the same way. I think they will do something because they have to. There's just too much scrutiny right now. The antitrust scrutiny is running hot. And actually, one thing that people aren't really talking about is Biden being president is very bad for these big tech companies, I think. I think they were all kind of waiting, and maybe Google was waiting even on this point. But I think that they just, as an ad network, and that's their core business, right? They can't replicate this ATT system. Well, I think what they're going to do is, I wrote a piece about this a while back. So they have the equivalent of the IDFA on Android is the GAID, right? Mm-hmm. And it functions in the exact same way. I think what they're going to do is so Firebase is, you know, the Google Analytics platform that app developers integrate, and that's their app analytics. Well, that already was doing attribution, just people didn't use it. So you could already run attribution through Firebase. I think what they're going to do is they're going to say, look, this has got to be your attribution platform. Use Firebase's attribution. Now, you as an app developer will only get back the sort of campaign level metrics from Firebase. But the ad networks will get back the in-app events. So we'll keep sending the GAID indexed events to the ad networks from Firebase, and we'll get them as Google, because we're an ad network, right? So all the networks will get these events, but you as an advertiser from Firebase will only get the campaign level events, kind of like what you're going to get from SK Ad Network. So that feels like a decent privacy compromise, because you could tell users, hey, these app developers aren't getting, you know, your GAID. They don't know who you are. They can't index this. And then, you know, while also basically not impacting the performance of the ad targeting.
Okay. So what is, like, what's, okay, no, I understand what Google is doing. I understand what Apple is doing. So what is Facebook going to do? Because they're kind of, you know, falling in between.
Man, that's a good question. I don't know. I think Facebook is playing chicken with Apple right now. So Facebook had said they were going to issue guidance around next steps. So they did this big dramatic, you know, right before iOS 14 was supposed to launch, before the delay, they did this big dramatic announcement, and they said, oh, you know, we have to change everything. We're going to kill off Fan. We're changing the way you're going to have to create a new advertiser account to run iOS 14 campaigns. And I mean, to be fair to Facebook, I mean, this was really damaging to them, and I don't know what they played this the right way, but it's kind of like when one of those soccer players falls on the ground in a soccer match, like, come on, buddy. You know what I mean? He didn't touch you. I mean, this is different because Apple really did touch Facebook, but I mean, they're just like, they were making a show of it. It was a clean tackle. And this guy's writhing around, you know, like his leg is broken in 18 places. But so they made this big show of it, and they said, look, you know, this is going to be very damaging. And then the delay happened, and they just didn't, they kind of did an update, and they said, okay, well, you don't have to make a new ad account, and we're probably going to be able to give you more than 9 campaign IDs to use, because there's all these limitations. But they didn't issue any other guidance. And they said originally they were going to issue more guidance in end of November. Well, it's December 1st, right? I think they're playing chicken because they know how catastrophic this is for some advertisers, right? And even, like, I would say for every advertiser, it's a big pain, and every advertiser is probably going to, going to, you can't operate the same way. And so every advertiser, if they try to operate in the same way, is going to see like a loss of efficiency. Now, some are going to adapt to the new environment and be better off in the medium term, but in the short term, it's going to be pain. It will be painful for everybody, I can say. And so, you know, I think Facebook's just saying, look, you know, there's nothing we can do. Apple needs to provide the guidance, and, you know, we're just an ad network, which in reality they're okay. The number one ad network, but they are just an ad network. Apple does need to kind of, you know, light the torch here and show the way, which they're not doing a very good job. I mean, Apple's not handled this, I think, in a very organized fashion. And they could have been much more deliberate and much clearer around this. And they've kind of taken the normal Apple approach, which is like, we're going to give you just like a very little information and we're very secretive and it's going to be very cryptic, but that doesn't work. Right. You know, first of all, you had a pandemic going on. People aren't in the same office. It's hard to coordinate these efforts in the first place. Mm-hmm. Now we're going into the holidays. Like, come on, they should be a lot more. I think they should be a lot clearer here. And I mean, it's causing like real grief to developers.
Well, that's how Apple normally works. I mean, and it's not that the individuals are secretive, but to my experience, it's like they don't share much information internally.
Yeah,
because they don't want it to leak and so forth and so forth. So as a culture, they've kind of keep a lid on all the information. So it gives outside the view that these guys are so secretive, but the fact that they just don't know, like the individuals don't know. So I understand that has happened to me multiple times. And then you kind of understand like, oh, you don't know. It's like, well, yeah,
right.
Let us know. Like they know when a new iPhone is released, the moment you know, then when the new iPhone is released, yeah. There's no information.
Yeah, that's totally true. It's like I interviewed there for a job. I don't know. It was weird. They were like, yeah, they reached out and they wanted to, you know, they like, we want to hire you. And I did like 3 on-site interviews and I didn't get it. But at one point I had an interview with like, I think a pretty senior person in the EMEA team. And he was telling me about their culture. It's like, yeah, I mean, the person that sits right next to you may not know anything about what you're working on and you can't let them know anything. Like we're very secretive here. And I was like, this is kind of odd. I don't know if I could deal with that. And then I was like, you guys know, I read a blog about right? it.
Can I?
Yeah. Like, why'd you even reach out to me? Yeah. Like, you know, I write this blog and I'm just blabbing on Twitter all day long. Like, why would you want, why do you think my personality would be a good fit for this kind of environment?
And so you missed out on the great gig with iAds, right?
No, it wasn't iAds. It was to be the EMEA App Store rep, which it was funny because I didn't get it, which I didn't. It was weird because I was like, okay, there's no way they're going to bring me in for another round of interviews. And they kept bringing me in and they brought me into like the last round and they're like, okay, this is the last round. And I had to pitch, like I had to pitch as if I was an app developer pitching them for featuring. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of weird because that wasn't like a showcase of how I'd handle that job. But anyway, I think I thought I handled that fine. And then they told me I didn't get it. And then I met, so then at Slush, and then I heard about the person who got it. And at Slush, I threw my party, you know, the party that I used to throw every year.
Parties that you used to throw every year everywhere. So I don't even know which party you're talking about.
I know COVID disrupted everything. COVID really threw a monkey wrench into my party schedule. So, you know, that venue that I had it at, they had like 2 venues. It's the front venue, which is like the actual restaurant or the restaurant slash bar. And the back was like a dedicated party venue. And that was the first year I was throwing it. So I went and I accidentally walked into the party venue, not knowing which one mine was, which one I'd reserved. And that person who had got that job was at the door and they're like, what are you doing here? And I was like, oh, sorry, I'm kind of my party. Like, this is not your party. This is an Apple party and you have to be on the guest list and you are not on the guest list. And I was like, whoa, relax. I was like, and I kind of realized, like, oh yeah, there's another van. I was like, okay, here. And so I think that person knew about me as well. I thought I was like coming to crash the party or something. I don't know.
Is that person German?
No.
That would have been more interesting in a German accent.
would have been scary in a German accent.
What are you doing here? all right. That's weird. Though on the other hand, if you would have been Apple rep, you'd be like 400 pounds right now because everybody's taking you out all the time.
Oh man. Yeah.
Best dinners. The best news I've ever had is with Apple Wrap. So shout out. I can't wait for all this IDFA to get deprecated so we can take the Apple guys out again to all the best restaurants and pitch them our games.
Yeah, man. Well, I always lived in Europe when I was in a role where I would interact with Apple reps, and like in Berlin, there's not, I don't know, maybe I just never went to the, but there's not like, it's not like a restaurant call. It's not like a high end restaurant culture. It's like, yeah, there's tons of,
let's be honest. They Schweine Schnitzel and Pommes frites. Come on. They do other things well, but not the food.
Yeah. The food, I mean, there's no food scene. And I don't think, I mean, maybe it's changed, but there's no food scene in Berlin. And then Helsinki, there's like, I think there's like a nascent food scene, but when I was living there, there was like no food scene. No. Like, it's not like, you know,
it's a little bit.
Yeah. No, it's definitely much better than when I was living there. I mean, every time I go back, I'm kind of shocked at how much better it's gotten with like food and nightlife and stuff. San Francisco's got a food scene, but it's like, yeah, the only clientele they cater to is business, because you're not going out.
No.
You're not going out to dinner in San Francisco without dropping like $400.
Oh, the rep dinners, like the best rep dinners are always in San Francisco. Like you go to those Michelin star restaurants.
Yeah.
Like sometimes if you go all the way to 3-star Michelin in San Francisco, then you can get both Google and Apple reps in the same room. Just saying. I've seen this before. This happens.
I wonder how big does your account have to be to like to get them to take you to French Laundry? That's got to be like a pretty. That's Playrix is getting the French Laundry treatment.
That's true. No, we're not hating on it. It's a good gig. It's a really good gig, and now they will have again more power. So I'm actually looking forward. I've always had fun with both of the reps, both Google reps and Apple reps. I think they're great, and it's like a fun conversation. Usually surrounded by the best food you can get. So looking forward to that. All right, so let's switch gears for another thing. So I wrote a little bit on marketability, which I don't write that much about. And I kind of, you know, I wrote about marketability being a loop and not a funnel. So I kind of wanted to get your opinion on this. And let's take a step back, because I've got a lot of comments and I don't want to, you know, keep repeating myself, but this is my experience with marketability. Like let's slash all the Facebook days. Let's go to like 2017. And back in the days I was working at FunPlus and King of Avalon was crushing it. Like top one grossing on a few days actually in the world. So really successful game. And of course there were a bunch of creatives that were being run, and one of the creatives were doing fantastically. Like the ROAS were out of control. It was really pulling a lot of players. And that was the kind of creative I'm sure people remember if you've ever seen strategy ads on Facebook. It's the one where you have these kind of like 1700, 1600s, like Cossacks. They're kind of traveling. Like, it looks like an RTS game. They're going somewhere, and then that rider gets back, and then they get ambushed, and there's like cannons and musketeers and that kind of stuff. And naturally, it has nothing to do with King of motherfucking Avalon. Like musketeers and that, the nothing to do with it. Nevertheless, absolutely fantastic performance. And the decision was made, because this ad does so well, is why not to reskin King of Avalon and call it, you know, Guns of Glory. And that is made, and it was, you know, hyper successful, doing even better than King of Avalon or almost on par. So just basically you double your revenue with lower CPI. So of course the company was like, oh my God, we found the secret on how to multiply your money all the time. And that is marketability. So there was a lot of investment being done in marketability, and that's where I've seen this marketability stuff working. And one time we did a lot of tests, and there was a multiple different themes. And one of the themes that really, really stood out was the one with dinosaurs and lasers. And people who have worked with me know that I fucking love dinosaurs and lasers because it really stands out. And this actually became a game. So it was called Dino Wars. So you can still find it on the App Store. And it's, again, same game. It's King of Avalon. It's Guns of Glory. But now with dinosaurs, with lasers that are being ridden by guys. So it's just insane. And this game was a fail. Like it just despite having the highest IPM, despite performing by far the best that we've ever seen. So I was kind of bummed on marketability tests, because I've seen one perform phenomenally, and I've seen the other one where the indications were even better perform not that well. And so I didn't know what to believe. Then fast forward a little bit, I was visiting this racing studio. They make only racing game, and they talked about how they approached the development. And one of the things that they kind of believed in is launching game as fast as possible, because they were like, well, we don't trust marketability that much. And essentially we're making racing games, so we just want to get fast to the market and see the numbers. And then we decide whether we want to continue or not. Pretty smart, right? You know, you have all the assets for cars, so that should be pretty easy. So they spend between 3 to 6 months to make a game, to launch that and to basically soft launch a game. And one of their games, I'm not giving away too much. This game looked really sick. I mean, it had drifting and the early metrics were fantastic. Like after 6 months of development, it looked like the next big hit. It looked better than CSR. So, and this is not CSR Studio. Anyway, so everything went great. They decided to invest a lot into this game and kind of complete it and just add more content, and it totally bombed. It just didn't retain actually players when it went further than that. And they couldn't scale in any way. So they were in a kind of a pinch, and they had one game in development that had absolutely shitty day one retention. I'm talking about like just can this game right away D1 retention. Like don't even look at it and fire the person who made it type of day one retention. Don't ever speak his name again in the studio. So they were kind of forced, their hand was forced to launch this game because, you know, so they just had to, because they invested so much in this one. And it became their best grossing game ever. So not that the day one retention grew anywhere, but it actually stayed stable. So the curve was pretty much stable. And the outcome from these are just two examples. Of course, there's multiple different examples. I like talking to different studios and understanding how they make games, because everybody has a different philosophy and everybody's philosophy of making. But I had these two examples that I wanted to bring forward. And I was like, what the fuck? Like marketability, launching fast, nothing seems to really result in anything. You can go really fast and fail. You can test marketability early on and fail or succeed or other ways around. So when I wrote about like marketability being a loop, it kind of came through this point of understanding audience a little bit better. So I've done focus group tests before, and they are very expensive. They take a long time, and they're very much dependent on who runs them. So my experience from them was also quite varied. And then I started using this platform. I don't know if you've tried 12 Traits, but I'm sure there are other type of platforms like that. But nevertheless, I started using 12 Traits, and it had very much like this detailed information about your audience. And what I really liked is you can actually just press a button and that audience gets transformed to your Facebook marketing campaign. So you can actually start testing it. And the way I understand marketability now is I really need to hone in on the target audience so I can create the type of creative and type of feel. Then I test that through the marketability, and I just don't stop there. It just has to be constantly ongoing.
Right.
Because your audience changes, the market changes, everything changes. You can't be like, boom, yep, we got the IPM of this or the CPI of that. We're done. Let's go forward. Let's invest 2 years into development or you know, X amount of millions. You just have to be constantly doing it and constantly understanding who your audience is. And through that, you're able to continue scaling. Because one of the feedback that I got also is like people tested marketability early on, and then, but they didn't know how big the audience was. So they couldn't scale the game, or the CPIs went out too fast. And for me, it's the loop question. It's like, well, was that the same audience? Were you acquiring a different type of audience? Were the expectations different? Like you have to keep on changing your creatives based on who you are acquiring in order to keep CPIs low. So that's kind of like summary that I kind of wrote and didn't have time to explain to people who were just, you know, pinging me.
No, you, Morpheus handed you the red pill, man. That's the learning. That's like the next level of awareness. So you're totally right. And I mean, I feel like that's something that I've just had a hard time articulating in the past, because it's complex, right? And I think a lot of times, especially at game studios, and I would say maybe more so at game studios than like if you think about just a consumer app, right? Like a Airbnb or something. But you've got the UA team and the product team. And like if things instantly, if the sort of configuration of like, hey, we picked this audience and it perfectly matches this game, if those don't just align right out of the bat, almost by chance, then it's just finger pointing. You're not bringing the right players in. It's like, well, the game is not optimized. But and so that feedback loop, that is so important. And that's why I think like a UA team is not, I've come to hate the phrase user acquisition. I think that's not, I don't think anybody should want to be a user acquisition person. I think it's a dead end job, first of all. But second of all, I think that just that describes like a very sort of like stiff, almost superficial group of people that just like clicks buttons in Facebook Ads Manager. You want to be the person that kind of wraps their arms around that entire funnel and manages that ping pong back and forth feedback loop. That's a real job, right? That's having impact on product. That's having impact on marketing. And I think a big part of marketing is that audience development, understanding the audience and understanding, hey, you know, well, we can bring the game appeals to this audience. So let's go chase that audience. Hey, that there's not that many of that audience or they're really competitive to reach. Well, hey, then you know what? Let's take back to the product and say, you know what? We shouldn't build a product that appeals to that audience because they're too expensive to acquire. So let's find another audience. Let's change the app. Let's change the product in such a way that when we bring in this different slice of people, this different group of people, they actually like the product. And that kind of back and forth feedback loop, that is product development, really, to my mind.
Yeah.
But I thought your piece hit on that really well. It's like, you know, you could do a straight up CPI test, and that's a data point, right? It's not necessarily like useless. That gives you a data point. But really, it's that development. It's like, it's almost like you're almost taking the first derivative of that. That's how you get to real progress. It's like, okay, now let's change it and see the rate of change and how much can we scale this, right? Because like, okay, I can run a test and do, you know, 100 players, right? And the CPI was low, right? Mm-hmm. And well, okay, we don't have any monetization because it's a really early beta. So we don't know what the ROAS is. But even if we did, how far does that scale?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
But you got to be careful with that word loops because you're going to trigger people because there's this whole school that's kind of come to the fore around like quote unquote growth and like growth hacking. Like, you know, the growth hackers of like 2017, 18,
yeah,
they
yeah.
kind of they evolved into this same kind of like pseudo intellectual milieu. But now they call themselves like growth experts or like just, you know, growth artisans, and they talk about growth loops all day, and it's just like the most like inane stuff you've ever read. But if you use that word loop, you're going to turn off a lot of people because they're thinking you're talking about like growth loops. Like I don't know, did you see that thread about the guy or that thread with that that bozo he's got this 20 tweet thread mm-hmm. talking about why OnlyFans is successful. And he's talking about the growth loops and he's talking about, oh, it's the growth, it's the loops. And he doesn't once mention the fact that it's porn and it's in a pandemic, right?
Listen, I'm not on Twitter. Like, I know you're on Twitter. I'm on Twitter, but I'm not on Twitter. Like, stuff, and I never read anybody's tweets. So if you tweet at me or you do whatever topic, I do not care less. Like, I just fire and go away. But I like the word triggered. Maybe we should call this podcast series like triggered growth or something like that.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
So for me, it really was about that understanding of the audience. And then I had a lot of talks with Joe from 12 Traits, and he was kind of going through multiple different, you know, examples and companies they worked with and walking me through of the change of the audience inside the game and how big of an impact that is really on marketing. And we've had that before, like from the product side, you're always, you know, going crazy when your D1 starts dropping and then the that are being acquired are worse than before. You're like, what's going on? What's happening?
Right.
But they're actually just different. So yeah. Well, listen, last thing that I wanted to cover with you. Since we're triggering, let's talk about Apple's platform reduction fee. So, you know, everybody knows it. So basically if your company makes less than $1 million, you have to pay only 15% tax to Apple instead of a 30. And then if it goes over that million, then they start basically, you know, charging you for the full 30 of what goes over that. This really touches most of the app developers, to be honest, because there's like a million of them. But it doesn't, of course, affect the ones that actually bring the money. So this is a kind of like an interesting juxtaposition of catering to majority that is not actually bringing, that brings only absolute fraction of your whole revenue.
Right.
It's actually like paying like 2% or less than 2% of the whole revenues for the whole service. So what do you think about this?
I mean, I think it was just brilliant. This was a masterclass in taking control of the narrative. because exactly what you just said, this doesn't affect their revenue at all, but it affects the vast majority of app developers. You can be like, yeah, Apple's listening. Yeah. And hey, they are, right? They are. But it, Epic's, and I mean, Tim Sweeney just threw a temper tantrum. I mean, well, no, Tim Sweeney, they baited him and he took it, and he starts comparing himself to Rosa Parks, or he starts saying all this stuff. He starts bringing this back to, you know, the 60s, with racial equality. And it's like, dude, you just got played. You just, cause now the story's about, what are you talking about? Are you kidding me? He got played so bad. That was horrible PR for Epic. I don't know if they have a PR team, because I imagine it's pretty hard to contain Tim Sweeney. But if they do, they were not happy. Yeah. They got played. They got baited. That was a bear trap that Apple set. No, it's like, you're making me sit in the back of the. It's like, what? What are you talking about? You're a billionaire.
Yeah.
What do you? it was perfect PR. Yeah, I think I did like a really quick rough and dirty analysis. I mean, it was less than 2% of revenues would be affected or something. Honestly, Apple's fee was already low. That 30% is historically low, right? I think people don't get that context, right? Like, I remember someone telling me that, you know, when there were a bunch of game developers in the audience at the first WWDC that the App Store was introduced, and when Steve Jobs announced that, oh yeah, we're only going to take a 30% cut, they just started cheering. Because the rates that they paid to get games published on dumb phones were just so high, right? And I was actually just doing an analysis of Roblox's S1 for this project I'm working on with a few people. And if you look at the take rate for Roblox, I mean, it's like Roblox, they say on average, the developer gets 24.5% of revenues, right? And so that's the revenue that their game is generating. They get 24.5% of it. So I mean, if you compare 30% across the board, that's the norm, right? And that's historically low from, you know, the dumb phone era or all these other sort of publishing platforms. So I think, like, you know, these big companies that are complaining about it, it's like, well, I get it. Like it's kind of, you know, at this level of scale, like, yeah, okay, you're giving up a big chunk of your revenue, but like historically that's low. And then relative to other platforms, that's pretty low.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, I know we covered this in a weird way on Twig, because Kress was very much like defending Epic, and I agree with you. It's definitely really good communication from the Apple. It's that's where you get when you have a good comms team and you can kind of control the narrative. But yeah, it's I don't know. There's nothing really that the developers can do now. It's kind of like a weird position. Like, they are really changing the game, and we understand why they're doing it, because of the Facebook and the Google situation, and they're kind of taking more ownership of their own platform. But then at the same time, it's like, I don't know, they're hurting the developers, but then they're doing something good for the majority of them, but the minority is getting hurt and that kind of stuff. So it's a weird situation, and things are changing slowly. Like, you've been writing about these platform wars for 3 years, 4 years, right? And only now we're kind of seeing what happens, and now the discoverability is being worked on. But when is that going to change? Is it going to be like Netflix in 5 years or something?
Right. Yeah. I think it's interesting. I don't know. Did you read that article that was going around about Roblox, and it's got a lot of concentration in like the number one game, and how to get around that? And it was, the author kind of proposed these three solutions that, I mean, it was a thoughtful piece, but I think the solutions he proposed weren't realistic. One of them was, well, just apply a decreasing take rate. Mm-hmm. Apply an increasing take rate, right? So, you know, Valve has a decreasing take rate. As the developer's revenue scale, they actually pay less. They pay less of a platform fee. So that incentivizes them to invest. And this person's, one of their proposals was, well, imply an increasing take rate, right? So the low, you know, the, which is kind of like what Apple's doing, but it was more progressive. It was, you know, there were more tiers. And I was thinking, well, that's just going to piss developers off, because like the more successful they are, the more money they're giving up. And it's like an increasing tax, right? But that doesn't really motivate more investment in the platform. And you're going to get to a point where like, hey, the optimal level investment is right here. If we invest any more, we're not getting as much money back. And then one of the other proposals was like, we'll force them to do cross promo to other people's apps. It's like, well, that's not going to work either. No one wants to lose their users to another. It's like the only way to get over this is to motivate more investment from the developer, make them more excited about the opportunity on the platform, right? And so I think this Apple's kind of towing a tough line here, because if they had done the opposite and they said, okay, Epic's going to get hit with Epic's going to get hit with a lower tax, right? So once you get to some level, you pay less. Then the vast majority of people would be like, well, wait a minute, how? It's like that kind of argument that you hear in the U.S. Like, why does my secretary pay more in tax than I do, right? Yes. Like, you don't want, that's a bad situation to be in. So I think they handled it in the perfect way, and there's this minority of people, and they didn't get anything out of this. But you know, the vast majority did, and they're happy about it. And like, they listened to the kind of, you know, the small developers who were the ones that are the most vocal on Twitter and elsewhere, saying like, look, this 30%, it's unreasonable. I'm trying to make a living here, and you're taking 30% off the top. Yeah. Whereas, you know, you got Fortnite, which is like the biggest game that's existed in the last X years, and it's also multi-platform. And also, let's face it, the reason Epic's whole battle here is to clear the path for them to put the Epic Store on the App Store, so that they can charge developers 12% of revenues. Like, they're not charitable, right? They're not running a charity.
yeah, this is really interesting. And what do you like? Where do you see this going? Is it going towards, you know, if we consider Chinese market? I don't know too much about Chinese market, but they used to have tons of different app stores, but now they have more than we do, but less what they used to have. Is this going towards that type of direction? Is Facebook gonna push towards having, you know, their app store?
Yeah, I think they want to, but that's part of what I was talking about in the recent kind of series I did about the future of platforms. I don't think it won't be like an app store like what we're used to, like the app store. It won't be a competing app store. I don't think that ever gets past. I don't think that ever gets past Apple's like reluctance to do that. But I think what it looks like is, you know, first of all, did you see that Google Stadia and Nvidia's game streaming services are moving to the mobile web, right? So they can do this and on the mobile web. And Facebook's got its games platform that's on Android. It's on the mobile. It's on desktop web. They'll move it to mobile web. I think it looks like that. I think it looks like Facebook operates. I interact with Facebook on my phone. I interact with Facebook on my Facebook portal. I interact with Facebook on my desktop. Maybe it's somebody I interact with on my TV. I think that's the platform. The platform is this like this tissue, this connective tissue that sits between all these different form factors and touches me in different like moments of the day, or touches me at different frequencies. Mm-hmm. And that's it. And so like, does it really matter that Facebook can't have a Facebook games app? If I could load it up in my browser, or if I'm interacting with Facebook and all these different touch points anyway, that aren't dependent on the app store, that aren't dependent on my phone. And then Apple kind of is operating, well, just one tiny sliver of that entire sort of, entire sort of constellation of input devices that I interact with every day. I think that's where Apple may have backed themselves into a corner. Like, long-term strategically, that's bad for Apple, right? If they're just operating one of these items, and the big platforms that interact with are these things that operate across all these different form factors that I touch every single day.
Yeah, that makes total sense. Because even now, if we consider Chinese market, a lot of games are just being directly promoted so that people can just install the APK and start playing the game instead of going through the store. And of course, you 90% of your revenues versus giving like 50 or whatever the shares are with the platform holders. That makes total sense. So they're kind of fighting for the pie that currently exists versus thinking about what's going to happen in the future where the pie is moving, you know, to the cloud essentially. And you don't need the storefront to get to the store.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
No, And then so essentially like in the long term, actually Facebook is in a better position because they're just investing into this distribution. And the distribution is it doesn't matter whether you have to go through the store or whether it's just purely in a browser.
Right. And then at some point that dependency flips, right? If Facebook gets there with any of these products, and users are like, hey, wait a minute, I want to play my Facebook games on my iPhone. Why are you making this hard for me? Then Apple's got to relent, right? Because it's they're sort of, they're slaves to the user. They're slaves to the customer. And if the customer wants it, they have to do it. Right. And if Facebook is allowed outside of the Apple ecosystem to grow and grow and grow this sort of like this kind of connection of this muscle tissue, this connective tissue, then Apple at some point it will just be under too much pressure from customers to sort of resist having it.
I get it. This is fascinating. All right. Let's wrap this up. Eric, how do people can get hold of you?
Well, you can find me on Twitter, at Eric_Sufert, LinkedIn, of course, and then mobiledevmemo.com.
And podcast too, mobiledevmemo.com podcast is there. You've been doing some great episodes, especially one on the, I think it was an IDFA you did a few weeks back. It was like almost 2 hours.
I think we had Nebo and David Phillipson on. Yes. That was a good one.
Yeah. People have been sharing that to me. I was like, man, I've been hearing too much about IDFAs.
So. Tell me about it. Yeah.
that's your whole job. All right. We're going to continue doing this if you guys want it. So this is the first episode of Triggered Growth. just named directly on the podcast. So catch you guys later.
Bye.
Bye.